Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in moments, we'll hear from education policy professor David Bloomfield on what's happening with education policy as Arne Duncan leaves the cabinet and John King replaces him. And then at the bottom of the hour, New Republic staff writer Elizabeth Brunig will talk about the politics of the Catholic Church in the wake of the Pope's visit. First, David Bloomfield. Arne Duncan is leaving as Secretary of Education, and Barack Obama has nominated John King to take his place. Both are loyal adherents to the doctrines of education reform. Testing, metrics, closing traditional public schools and replacing them with charters. During his tenure, Duncan had over $4 billion appropriated in the 2009 stimulus bill to reward states that complied with his and Obama's race to the top agenda. King won't have that, or much time either. Here's David Bloomfield, a professor of education policy at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center, to tell us what it all means. Welcome, David Bloomfield. Arne Duncan is on the way out. How would you evaluate his tenure?
Well, a huge disappointment from those who were hoping that Linda Darling-Hammond would be the Secretary of Education. She had run Obama's transition office for education, I would say from the left, and then we got Arne Duncan from the right. And it has been all accountability all the time since then.
Now, he's made his bones in Chicago, right?
Right.
What did he do there?
Well, he was really a budgeteer for Mayor Daley, the second Mayor Daley. And so he had no real background in education. He had sat at his mother's knee. His mother ran a well-known tutoring program in Chicago. And he basically brought a management style to the Chicago public schools.
Which meant what?
Really meant school closures as a strategy for school improvement, which of course is kind of like destroying the village to save it. And because Chicago really does have massive budget problems, he used that as an excuse to really denude neighborhoods of their schools and to try to make the metrics go up, but they didn't. And the graduation rate and then other typical metrics for school improvement were flat.
And this, of course, is the program that Rahm Emanuel has intensified.
That's right. But Duncan was one of the earliest people to bring that style of business accountability to public schools. Then subsequently, really, Paul Vallis in Chicago and New Orleans and Joel Klein in New York City adopted that. And then it was cloned by Eli Broad, the philanthropist, who started to seed many urban school systems in the country with that kind of closure and obsession with test scores that we see today.
And I was just reading that Broad is quite close to Hillary Clinton.
Oh, my God. Well, so is Randy Weingarten. I don't know what to do about that. Broad is a big Democratic fundraiser. And it has to be understood that a lot of this, if probably most of it, certainly Arne Duncan, came from the Democrats. This wasn't some sort of horrible Republican right-wing conspiracy. This is what Obama, and Obama has to take ownership, it's not just Arne Duncan, for nationalizing this obsession with test scores, school closures, charter schools, and other what are called school reform or school deform policies.
Now, these guys really love metrics, or profess to, but the metrics do not support their claims about this agenda, yet they are constantly redoubling their efforts. Where does this come from?
Well, I really think it comes from focus group reactions. I mean, this is not an educational strategy, it's a political strategy. And if you sat down a bunch of Americans and said, you know, what do you think of school choice? What do you think of school competition? What do you think about school accountability? all the hands would go up. And so what we really have is instruction by focus group and the kind of buzzwords that voters react to.
But then, as you pointed out earlier, Broad is a big funder, and the other funders, the hedge fund guys, love this stuff too, right?
Well, right. So it's a reflection of that mentality. It ends up, whether in the first instance or later, being anti-union, anti-regulation. This is what gave rise to the charter schools. Charters are about choice and competition and accountability and deregulation. And these people made their millions, billions off of that kind of mindset. And in a plutocratic sense, they've been able to impose that mindset on the American public education system.
I was going to say this stuff has been going for a long time, but just how long has this agenda been underway?
I suppose it probably starts with the Chicago School of Economics and Milton Friedman, who suggested that vouchers were the way to go in terms of public schooling. A guy named Paul Hill picked that up with the idea of charters, which also have I would say, segregationist aspect to it. It was a way of people escaping a public school system that during the 70s and 80s was becoming more desegregated. This was a way for people, rather than having white flight, having sort of black flight into the charter schools. And we do find that charter schools have a segregating effect on the public schools around them.
The charter schools in New York City are overwhelmingly black, right? Like almost close to 100%.
Yeah, and that's partly a result not only of intention on the part of charter school operators, but the way the laws are written. So the law says that a charter school is intended to give preference to racial minorities or really, you know, poor kids, which ends up being racial minorities. And so it has an intentionally segregative effect in the idea that somehow the public schools are bad and the charter schools will improve the lot of the poor.
Of course, they're not very interested in kids whose first language is not English, though, right?
Well, you know, going to this accountability thing, and again, it's a both an intention and an artifact of the charter school movement, that how do you decide whether the charter should be renewed or not? And you look for these quantitative measures. And, you know, I want to go back and just talk about the attractiveness of quantitative measures, which crowd out qualitative measures. And so, you know, if you get a 10, nobody says, well, you know, the margin of error could be a 5 or a 15, you know, that number sticks. And then part of the problem is progressives speak in nuance. Progressives say they don't have the answer, that it's a lot of different things. And then in walks in Arne Duncan, says, I have the answer, and the answer is race to the top. And so who are you going to go with, the person who's kind of fuzzy or the person who is selling their snake oil? And you buy the snake oil.
Well, he also had a big pot of money he was dangling in front of people, right?
Well, that's right. And so that was, in a sense, the first iteration of all this, of course, was No Child Left Behind, an emphasis on test scores, an emphasis on school closures.
And that was George Bush brought that with him from Texas, right?
Right, the Texas miracle, supposedly. And but you know, it was bipartisan. The deal was a kind of deal with the devil. Again, money fueling that, was Teddy Kennedy said, I'll back this if you throw a whole lot more money into Title I. And George W. Bush says, okay, but we're going to have annual testing in math and reading and science. And that was the deal.
And was there any empirical evaluation of how the No Child Left Behind thing worked?
Well, we know that from the start it was going to be a train wreck. There was no way that by 2014, which was the timeline engineered into No Child Left Behind, that every child was going to be proficient in math and reading. So it was more snake oil. Everybody in Congress knew it, but in trade for money, the president got accountability, and he was able to push that for re-election.
And I suppose a lot of progressive Democrats were hoping that when Bush left and Obama came in, that the education policy would change dramatically, and they just got more of the same, right?
That's right. And what happened was that in addition to the stimulus money that was used for Race to the Top, they engineered this competition for the money where just to enter the race, you had to change your state statutory formula to provide for teacher evaluations and these other aspects of accountability that Duncan ushered in. Finally, when it turned out that the the No Child Left Behind stakes were creating failing school after failing school after failing school, and they were going to have to upend the process, Duncan came up with this idea that he was going to institute waivers for No Child Left Behind and the sanctions under them if schools did even more, double down on the accountability, double down on the testing, double down on limiting the curriculum to math, reading, and science. So we're left with something even worse than No Child Left Behind, the Bush legacy, which is the Race to the Top and what they call flexibility at the Department of Education currently.
I'm speaking with David Bloomfield, who's a professor of education policy at Brooklyn College and also at the CUNY Grad Center. So now Arne Duncan, who I think was the perhaps the longest or almost the longest serving cabinet member, has now left, and Obama has nominated to succeed him John King of New York State. So give us the resume of John King.
Yeah, well, John King started out professionally with the Renaissance Charter School in Boston, then became a chain operator, the Uncommon Schools, and was selected to become the Deputy Commissioner of Education for New York State, where he served under another corporate reformer named David Steiner. And when Steiner left, in part because of the debacle over installing Kathy Black as the Condé Nast executive as New York City Schools Chancellor and granting her a waiver, he left and King took his place. He was probably Commissioner of Education in New York for, I guess, 3 or 4 years and adopted the test till they drop model, pushing teacher evaluations and testing, so much so that in this current testing cycle, 20% of New York State parents kept their kids home from the tests.
King is not terribly popular with lots of folks, right? I mean, he had a constituency in Governor Cuomo, but a lot of parents were really pretty fed up with his regime.
That's right. You know, when he left for the feds, where he was installed as Arne Duncan's second in command, it was good riddance, John. Everybody was, or many, many people, parents, teachers, were overjoyed that he was leaving.
Now, you said he ran a chain of charters?
Yeah, I believe, I should double check, but I believe they're called Uncommon Charters, and again, you know, hedge fund sponsored, and generally speaking, being part of that whole private-public hybrid that are charter schools, public money, private operation.
And non-union?
I believe non-union.
Well, but of course, the charter agenda is a lot about reducing the power, or if not breaking completely, the teachers' unions, right?
That's right.
And how are they succeeding in that project?
The charter school sector is growing by leaps and bounds with lots and lots of federal money. The typical charter model is that the districts where the charters are located have to pay the charter operator on a per pupil basis, the idea being that that child has now left the public sector and is now going to this privately operated charter school. So the money is saved by the school district and simply is shifted to the charter. That really doesn't work in real life because there are fixed costs that the district has, and the charter movement impoverishes not only the regular public school districts, but you can really see the demise of the Catholic parochial school system in many cities as the result of charter schools, which are free, and the parochial schools, of course, have to charge some amount because they're not getting that degree of public funding. Now, what isn't recognized is that the charter schools are getting hundreds of millions of dollars out of the Obama administration and Congress because federal funds are paying a lot of money for charter school programs and charter school space.
And how does does Teach for America fit into the charterization?
Teach for America, of course, is this system where newly minted college graduates go into urban schools, usually, for a couple of years. Their teacher preparation is minimal, and it's kind of this white savior of poor children model. And, of course, those teachers, since they only have a two-year obligation and in many cases are just having their ticket punched to improve their resumes before they go off into the private sector or business school or law school, they're not interested in long-term contracts, unionization, salary protections, pensions, and so it fits perfectly into the charter school and hedge fund model of essentially exploiting kids so that these people at lower salaries, little preparation, can just move quickly through the system and on to their next gig.
When I interviewed conservative education pundit Terry Moe at the Hoover Institution a few years ago, he said a couple of interesting things I'd like to hear your reaction to. One is that there's no problem with the Teach for America's high turnover rate because teachers don't get any better after a few years, and there's no advantage to having senior teachers who just cost more, so just run these TFA kids through.
Yeah, well, that's just not true. Like any job, really, the improvement is over the first 5 years, and again, it's very hard to tell. We're talking about test scores, so it's kind of a bad metric based on a bad foundation. But if you look at test scores, our kind of only quantitative measure, the teachers improve over their first 5 years, and then they plateau, just like any worker kind of gets used to the job. And so when people start talking about, you know, sort of dead wood, they're not talking about dead wood. They're talking about people who have mastered their craft and are doing a pretty good job in general for the rest of their careers. We have a much worse problem in terms of teacher retention, keeping good teachers in the classroom, than we do moving bad teachers out. Half of teachers leave the profession after 5 years.
Is that share rising as they get more public disrepute?
It's very hard to get cause and effect here. The economy is getting better. People can move into other jobs. The amount of teaching jobs has actually declined because of recession and lack of public funds for teachers. You know, we talk a good game in America about improving education, but we're very parsimonious with tax money to support that vision.
So what might we expect from John King at education?
Well, I expect essentially more of the same. Of course, the race to the top money is gone, and the waivers have been granted. So in a real sense, I think he's going to be treading water for the next couple of years during these out years of the Obama administration. There is a chance. He recently addressed a diversity conference, and It could be because of all the publicity over Black Lives Matter that there may be a slight pivot toward trying to improve diversity in American public schools. That, of course, is the most important thing we could do to improve American public education. So maybe there'll be some light, but in general, this is a guy who has, throughout his career, supported charter schools, supported harsh penalties for low performance on testing. I said in a New York Times article at one point that he fetishized testing. And so I don't see him turning back because it got him where he's now the head of the entire federal education department.
In her book, Dana Goldstein says that desegregation has shown to be one of the best ways of improving educational outcomes for poor minority kids. We're moving away from that, or nobody even really talks about desegregation anymore. And charterization is a form of resegregation. So what do you think of that?
I think the pendulum does swing. I think more people are talking about desegregation as a strategy than they have been in the last decade or so. Supreme Court, of course, makes that very difficult under a case called Parents Involved, where except for a slight opening, the Supreme Court said that race could not be a factor in school placement. So whether that is either politically or legally palatable is a good question, but it's now an open question, and nobody was talking about it a few years ago.
And finally, based on, I mentioned earlier, metrics, based on these metrics, the reforms, by their own standards, I mean test scores, have really not delivered, no matter how you slice it. The charter schools themselves, at the best you can say, they're no worse than what they're supposed to be replacing. So we've gotten like close to 20 years maybe of this record, and the metrics that these people presumably love are not justifying their policy. How can this keep going on?
Well, I think that as we've been talking around the idea that these policies help and enrich a lot of people. The head of the Success Academy chain in New York City makes about $500,000 a year. If you read the New Yorker article about Jeb Bush and his connections with the charter industry in Florida, a lot of people made a lot of money that way too. So I think we can probably, the landscape and the sort of ecosystem of American schooling has changed to make room for profiteers. And as long as the profiteers have the money to grease the political wheels, I think whatever the metrics say will be kind of swept under the carpet, and we will have a continuing push for evaluations, for test score results, for charter schools. I am not overly optimistic, but as I said, and as you indicated, some of these failures do open up some opportunities to see poverty, to see segregation, those great American dilemmas, as something that the education system is going to have to directly confront rather than be distracted by the new snake oil.
I was David Bloomfield, Professor of Education Policy at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. are some of the first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 7, performed by the Juilliard Quartet. Next, Elizabeth Brunig. Liz is a staff writer for The New Republic, who's both a serious leftist and a Catholic. I grew up Catholic and gave it up at the age of 12 or 13. The recent visit by Pope Francis to the U.S. excited some of the best feelings I've had about the Church in my grown-up life. He says some fine things about poverty, inequality, and climate change. But then he says something retrograde about abortion or same-sex relations, and my good feelings quickly turn sour. In any case, I thought it'd be interesting to hear an analysis of his papacy and the current state of the Church from a Catholic leftist, Elizabeth Brunig. Welcome, Liz. So, first of all, what's going on in Rome now? There's a synod of the elders of the Church going on. Who are they? What are they discussing?
Right. So it's a synod of, you know, Catholic prelates, bishops, cardinals. They are representatives of their places in the world, and they are discussing the future of the family. This is it's not the second half, but it's a continuation of the same synod on the family that happened last year around this time. You know, last year there was a big kerfuffle. Everyone felt like the progressives in the Church had really kind of scored a coup, and there was much upset. And this year it's kind of looking a little bit different. It looks like the conservatives are kind of coming out swinging. So lots of anxious watching to see what will happen with divorced and remarried Catholics.
What was the progressive coup last year?
Well, you had the Casper proposal, which was a proposal drafted by Walter Casper. And it was that, you know, in some cases after penitence, divorced and remarried Catholics could be allowed to take communion again. There was also a big to-do because a midway report seemed to reflect that the Church might take a far more progressive stance on not only divorced and remarried Catholics, but Catholics in same-sex relationships. And, you know, basically conservatives felt like it was a bit of a repeat of Vatican II, and that many things were being upset all at once. And at the end, the final report didn't really reflect anything that was a wild upset. And in fact, we're still discussing whether or not divorced and remarried Catholics will be allowed to take communion. So it's not like there was a major coup, but there was enough progress made by progressive Catholics that, you know, conservatives got worried.
And of course, this year, after the Pope's visit to the U.S., many eyes will be on Rome to see whether the Kim Davis meeting was a portent of something or how it all fit in. What's your prognostication?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting watching that develop. It's been such a Rorschach test. You know, there's a great joke about the patient who's getting all of these Rorschach tests and says, well, I'm not a pervert, doc. You're the one who keeps showing me all those dirty pictures. And I felt like that was kind of what was happening with the Kim Davis story. Everyone was sort of seeing the worst possible outcome. Even conservatives who were at first excited that Pope Francis met with Kim Davis because she's sort of an icon of the kind of movement against same-sex marriage, were angry that he did it in private and did it in secret. And then as the story unfolded, it was much less than it was originally made out to be. It was basically a handshake. Pope Francis wasn't briefed on the details of her situation, and then the Vatican confirmed that the meeting was in no way a gesture of support for Kim Davis in her specific circumstances, unlike what her lawyers had suggested in their press releases. So then all of the conservatives who had kind of tentatively enjoyed and celebrated the liberal upset over Pope Francis meeting Kim Davis, and there was quite a lot of that, had to walk it back a little bit. And I think that a lot of that walking back has been done in expressions of terror over the synod. Here's Pope Francis' chance to finally destroy the family and sink the Church into apostasy and all of that.
I grew up in the Catholic Church, but I am not very far from it. We don't really quite understand the politics of the Church. The prelates gathered at the synod, who do they represent exactly? Are they just a sort of a self-perpetuating group of people who live their own insulated lives, or do they have some kind of responsibility to accountability to the base of the Church, the mass members, the 1.2 billion Catholics in the world?
They're definitely there for doctrinal clarification. So, I mean, Gary Wills writes very nicely about our Church and the other Church, the kind of Church of hierarchy and doctrine, and then the Church of people who are actually practicing Catholics. And there is definitely a contingent of prelates at the Synod who want to represent the Church as it is actually practicing. And that's the sort of progressive argument that we need a more pastoral approach that takes into account how the Church is actually living. And then the more conservative argument is, well, the Church has never probably lived in totality according to the rules, the doctrine, because people are what they are. But nonetheless, that's never been a compelling reason for the Church to drop doctrine or to radically change it. So that's kind of part of what's at stake, is how does the church respond to the world? Do we rely on doctrine, or do we take a pastoral approach that kind of integrates how Catholics are actually living Catholicism?
And what about the relation of Francis to that hierarchy? Some people are saying that he was hoodwinked into meeting with Kim Davis by reactionaries in the American Catholic hierarchy, yet he was elected pope, presumably by people who knew what he was all about. What is the relation between him and the folks in the red hats?
Well, there are a lot of conspiracy theories. I'm not a Vaticanista. There are certainly people who are. There was definitely a prominent, you know, sort of conspiracy theory that loyalists to Pope Benedict, who were upset about his resignation in the election of Pope Francis, arranged the meeting with Kim Davis to sort of create a publicity situation that would destroy whatever positive effect Pope Francis' visit might have had and would really compromise him in the eyes of his sort of liberal audience. That was successful, if that was the intent. Of course, very difficult to prove intent. And then meanwhile, in terms of the synod, there's the theory that since Pope Francis was elected by a supposedly anti-Benedict gang of cardinals, he now owes them. And these include the sort of progressives who are trying to push through the Casper proposal.
We're throwing around this term progressive somewhat recklessly because, you know, on the one side you've got the Pope's stance on inequality and poverty and sometimes a pretty sharp critique of capitalism itself and certainly his commentary on climate change. On the other side, you've got moral doctrine, same-sex relations, marriage, divorce, the family, all these things for which the Catholic Church is famous for taking what some people see as a very conservative position. How do we reconcile these two sides of the Pope and how, you know, the audiences in the United States have seen him?
Yeah, well, I mean, I certainly am, just to clarify, I've been trying to use progressive and conservative inside the church to refer to cardinals and bishops who want a more pastoral stance, you know, in advancing the doctrine, and those who want to conserve the doctrine that's always been there. It's difficult with Pope Francis to kind of fit him into a label, and I know that point has been made ad infinitum, probably ad nauseum, but, you know, the Catholic Church, I think it's important to remember, is a pre-modern institution, and liberalism, the way that we now reckon progressivism versus conservatism, these are categories that emerge in the modern era. So the Catholic Church is just sort of speaking a different language in terms of rights and freedoms and the good and the common good than is spoken anymore. And I think that's what makes the opinions of people like Pope Francis, who is just a very orthodox Catholic, what makes those kind of stances look very strange is that on one hand, yes, as part of his reckoning of the common good and the purpose of creation, he has a very sharp critique of capitalism because the allocation of private property has a social mortgage. In Catholic thinking, you have to serve the common good with your use of private property, and endless accumulation is very much frowned upon. And on the other side, you know, after saying things that please American progressives like that, he makes points about sexual morality and the family that are, you know, again, very traditionally Catholic, that, you know, he's against abortion, he's campaigned against same-sex marriage, and all of these are of a piece in the Catholic anthropology and the Catholic view of what the human being is for. But, in, you know, in contemporary terms, they don't make a lot of sense.
To someone like Francis, there is a consistency in his positions, like a critique of utilitarian view of human life, for example. Could you draw out the, you know, the consistencies that secularists might not see?
Sure. So, I mean, you know, if you look at the critique of private property, for example, or the endless allocation and misuse of private property under capitalism that produces inequality, what is the earth for? The earth is created for all men in common. Then private property comes as an institution through civil government to mediate some of the evil that would arise without it. So with private property, you prevent certain forms of tyranny that would hurt the family or disallow people for arbitrary reasons from taking care of themselves and benefiting from creation. On the other hand, private property comes with a social mortgage. For private property to exist, we must first make sure that everyone is getting a cut of creation's bounty. This is the sort of old-fashioned distributist point. Economies have changed, the way we use resources have changed, resources themselves have changed. This is what Pope Francis is getting at with an interest in climate change. But I think his basic idea is the same, that creation was made for everyone, it has a purpose, the meaning of the material things that we have is to support humanity. So everyone should be able to benefit equally from that because all of us are equally the children of God and equal in human dignity. Thread that out one step and say, okay, so we know what creation is for and what came next, humankind, right? What is humankind for? Well, you have two different types of people. You have men and women. This is, again, the traditional Catholic view. And what are they for together? Well, they're for marriage together. And the marital act, sex, is for the creation of life. The generation of more human beings go forth and be fruitful. And so the same teleology that gives us what Pope Francis believes about private property, that creation is for a certain thing, and that's revealed in scripture and also through observation in nature, and then that, you know, human beings, men and women, are for a certain thing, again, revealed in scripture, but also the traditional argument goes visible in natural law, because that's what each of these things are for. This is what is good for them. So marriage with sex open to life is good, and an equitable distribution of resources is good by the same logic.
There's a critique of abortion, for example, that would view what doctors call the products of conception as disposable, that I think the kind of view of the world that you're outlining finds reprehensible. Is that what the thinking is?
Yeah, absolutely. The Catholic Church says that no human being is ever disposable. And, you know, there's a lot of history to reckon with there, because the Catholic Church, though now articulating, especially under Francis, a language of inclusion that is interested in lending as much dignity as possible to the human person, has not always exhibited that kind of behavior. So, you know, we have to reckon with our history, but I think that's exactly right.
But if we go back into Catholic history, the position on abortion is, what, from the late 19th century, right? It's not some timeless doctrine that the Church has held forever, is it?
Right. The Church has had, well, it's interesting. I mean, since at least Augustine and John Chrysostom and some of the early fathers of the 3rd, 4th, and 5th centuries, Christians have believed it was wrong to intentionally kill a fetus in the womb. The argument has been over when ensoulment happens, and at what point a fetus in the womb is really alive. Those have been a couple of arguments that have impacted the Church's official position on abortion. But the general sense has always been that, you know, children unborn are not for killing. That's not what they're best for. But there have been disagreements on when that act becomes killing.
But the consensus that, I think usually what, till quickening used to be at least one rule of thumb, right?
Right. When it kicks, when it moves around, yeah.
What happened in the 19th century that this became solid Catholic doctrine?
One of the interesting things about the Catholic Church versus, you know, for instance, some of the evangelical churches out there, is the Catholic Church really does try to respond to science. It's a weighty statement to make, but in certain situations, at least, the Church has made efforts to respond to science. And the Church's argument is that when we finally knew that from the moment of conception, cells were dividing and becoming a person, putting a fetus on the spectrum to, you know, a regular individual walking around, then we knew that abortion was a sin much earlier at the moment of conception than we had given it credit for prior. The Church says this is just the Church responding to knowledge.
Galileo might disagree with the Church's responsiveness to science.
Yeah, there are a lot of problems like that in the Church's history. But, you know, as far as I can tell, I've heard a lot of anti-abortion advocates talk about the change in the Church's policy over the year. And Helen Alvarez is, you know, she's an attorney. She's probably among the best people to listen to about this on account of having studied it for a couple decades. But that's her argument, is that the Church can only respond to what we know about the human body. When we knew better, we did better.
But now this is so at odds with thinking and practice in much of the world today. How long can the Church go on holding this position?
Well, the Church has thought a lot of really weird things for a really long time. I would never presume that the Church is going to just run out of steam for the support of doctrine like this, in part because every time someone poses that the world thinks about it differently, that's more evidence to the Church that they're probably doing the right thing on account of people being not reliable sources of moral clarity. But it's difficult because there are certain people within the Church who do feel like the Church should have a clearer continuity with the way that people actually live their lives.
Well, I think a lot of people would hear that and say, well, what do a bunch of celibates know about the challenges of abortion and family life and divorce and the rest?
Right. I mean, that's the sort of identitarian argument against the Church's authority on birth control and sexuality is, well, what do they know? They've never had sex. On one hand, they're not having sex, but I have to believe a lot of them did at some point. They also make statements about heaven and hell and their living people. But the church is it's limited in a lot of ways by the limitations of its members, but that's why we function together as a whole and we try to hold synods that draw on collective wisdom. And of course, the church believes that the Holy Spirit accompanies the church through history. So we also count on these decisions not being purely human in origin.
I'm speaking with Elizabeth Brunig, a staff writer for the New Republic.
But it seems like, at least in the United States, American Catholics really don't pay much attention to these teachings and live their life pretty much like everyone else does in this country.
Right, that's what the polling shows for sure.
So what does that do to the church's moral authority that its teachings are so widely disregarded by a very substantial portion of its membership?
Well, I mean, the church just says it's not a democracy. Pope Francis opened this synod by saying this isn't a parliament. You know, it's not a city council meeting. We're not going to vote on what we want the morality of the church to be. The church says that its morality is rooted in ontology, and you can disagree with the ontology. A lot of people do. The interesting thing about the mispractice of American Catholics in terms of doctrine is I don't think they would disagree with the ontology if you sat them down and ran them through it. It's just that it's easy to get a disconnect going between the church's ontology and its view of the human person and then its ethics, especially when we're so immersed in a culture that views contraception, for example, as a much better solution than abortion. You know, that's sort of the mainline Protestant argument. And it's very hard to discredit when you view it in the kind of harm reduction terms it's presented in. So the church would say we're not a democracy. The fact that you can't seem to practice Catholic doctrine correctly doesn't mean the doctrine's wrong. It just makes sort of a statement about humankind.
And so what does someone like you, as a politically, intellectually sophisticated Catholic, do with these contradictions? Do you try to follow the doctrine or take what you want and leave the rest?
I actually do try to be extremely consistent myself. You know, I'm a convert. I came to it because I chose it, and I chose it because I became convinced it was true. And once you believe something is true and that there's really no arguing with it, your options are not, am I going to do this? Am I going to come up with another thing to do? It's, do I obey or disobey? I do my best to obey, not that I don't sin, but I do try to obey. And my interest has always been in making sure that it's clear what the church says about things like private property, because that is actually, you know, we talk about Catholics not practicing the real sexual morality of the church. They equally don't practice the doctrines on social teaching. And that has always been disturbing to me, that that's the kind of shadowed half of the doctrine.
So what do you think the effects of the Pope's visit to the United States have been? What lasting effects that week or so do you see?
It's hard to say. I mean, in my office, when Boehner resigned, we were all laughing, saying that Francis made him do it. I don't think that actually happened. It's hard to say whether or not there will actually be a tangible Francis effect. It's been something that people have discussed since, you know, very early on in his papacy. I want to say that he has given a moral credibility to the project of reorienting our policy to prevent climate change. That's been roiling for a long time. You go back as far as, you know, the 60s and 70s, and there's definitely a moral weight to people who are campaigning about protecting the environment. But I think Pope Francis has kind of rejuvenated some of that moral reasoning behind climate care. And I've seen a lot of religious groups get involved recently in a way that I hadn't before, not only Catholic, but Protestant, and starting up organizations to care for the climate. So that's one of the things that I have high hopes for. I certainly hope that the progressive Christian cause is going to get a boost from it. That's languished in the United States for a long time now, but, you know, one can hope. And Pope Francis is very good at articulating what the orthodox case is for a sort of left Christian approach to especially economics and welfare. And so I hope that'll have a lasting impact.
Maybe I'm being unprincipled, but no, I, from my point of view, welcomed his visit and what he had to say. I thought it was, you know, providing some good ammunition for my side. A lot of American leftists were scornful of him just because he represents this old institution that's misogynistic and reactionary in so many ways. What did you think of the kind of reception he got from people on the left?
Well, you know, it's hard to watch what happens to Pope Francis when you feel close to him. I really appreciate him, you know, not only as a political but a religious figure. I think, you know, there were a lot of people on the left who were excited, who were welcoming Francis. I worried a little bit that there was like a booyah thing going on, like, haha, see, Pope Francis agrees with us, conservatives, what are you going to do now? Which just sets you up for an unfortunate Kim Davis-like mushroom cloud. So when the Kim Davis thing broke, a lot of people who had signaled support for Pope Francis or excitement about Pope Francis, then had to make equally harsh claims disclaiming him. Especially in online discourse, there's so much signaling. I'm a good leftist. I'm a good progressive. I now hate Pope Francis. I've given up on him. I mean, I saw posts like that for days. It's over. I'm snapping out of it. Forget him. He's an old bigot from Latin America. Yada, yada, yada. So that was very tough to witness, and I haven't really seen a lot of people walk it back. They've just quietly started posting the Vatican statements saying that the Kim Davis meeting wasn't all it was cracked up to be, but without any disclaiming of their prior behavior. So ultimately, I don't know how it's going to shake out. I suspect that the left will go quiet about him for a while.
Well, it's funny that there's a kind of moralizing quality about a lot of left discourse, which is, you know, if he's not perfect, then the hell with him. I mean, I don't agree with him on anything, so he's, you know, everything, and so he's worthless. I mean, there's this sense in which you're looking for a moral guide rather than some sort of political ally. It struck me as curiously purist of a lot of people to throw the guy over just because, you know, he didn't agree with them on everything.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a purity complex in online left discourse. There are a couple of more charitable interpretations I tried to work out in my head, one of them being that, well, you know, gay rights, that's a tenderer issue. It's a newer issue. It's a shorter-lived issue than, for instance, you know, interest in welfare, which is a very long-lived issue, or labor, long-lived issue that we argue about a lot. And perhaps the progressives who were compelled to make very strong statements about disclaiming Pope Francis felt like they had to protect an issue that is in a lot of its ways still compromised, still delicate, as opposed to there being plenty of, you know, very, very well-established, robust left discourse on inequality. At the same time, I tend to feel like the social issues are the more pronounced, even if they are the more tenuously accomplished.
More pronounced how?
They get more attention in the media.
Yeah, well, the media feels much more comfortable with that than talking about redistribution or the immorality of exploitation.
Right.
The same-sex issues. The church internally has certainly had plenty of experience with that. You know, we know a lot about priests and altar boys and all that. This is a very sensitive topic for the church to moralize about, isn't it?
It's an extremely sensitive topic for the church to moralize about. And I think that part of it is the specter of the sex abuse crisis. And I'm very proud of Pope Francis for how honestly he confronted that in the United States. And he has done that throughout his papacy. Of course, conservatives say that he's using cleaning house post-sex abuse crisis as a guise for removing conservative church leaders. So that's one of the conspiracy theories floating around out there, that he's not actually cleaning house as he says he is. That the people he's removing are not guilty of anything. They're just conservative and he's getting rid of them. On the other hand, I think he's been very vocal about taking accountability, taking responsibility.
Well, I read a lot of critiques of him for not being so forthright enough about the abuse problem, but you see him as having been so?
Well, certainly recently. I mean, early in his papacy, he did put together a task force consisting in part of victims of sex abuse who are helping him direct his efforts in not only cleaning house, but setting up prevention efforts and then receiving victims who are still interested in being a part of the church into care. He was very, very emphatic about taking responsibility when he spoke about the sex abuse crisis in New York. He said, "For those of you who told people in positions of authority, told bishops that you were being abused and you were ignored, please know that the Holy Father hears you and believes you, and that that should never have happened." So he took accountability for both halves of it. And that's a big step, I think. He not only took accountability for the actual sexual abuse, but the fact that the church did so much to cover it up and allow it to continue. He has made himself accountable for that, and that's something that has to happen.
It seems like it's very difficult to change a 2,000-year-old institution very quickly. Do you see him as having some kind of longer-term interest in changing some of the church's morality around sex and marriage and such?
I mean, interestingly, I don't see Pope Francis interested in doing that at all. He has been a very traditional figure in terms of sexuality and the family. What I think he really has an interest in doing is reintroducing the parts of Catholic doctrine, the social teaching, and in a care for the climate that have been recently set aside to deal with other problems, if you want to put it diplomatically, but have at any rate been ignored for a while. I think that his interest is in regaining the credibility of the church, in part through emphasizing all of these aspects of our belief that are pretty frequently shucked aside.
I was Elizabeth Brunig, a staff writer for the New Republic. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, the conclusion of the cadenza written by Beethoven for Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 20. It's performed by Friedrich Gulda, and you'll hear a few seconds of the Vienna Philharmonic conducted by Claudio Abbado at the end. Till next week, bye.